From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
The philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence tend to tell us that you should not get lost in a sea of despair, that you should be hopeful. You have to pick yourself up and continue to move. And Andy would say, press on to the mark. You have to keep going. I think one of the great moments of hope when we were marching from Selma to Montgomery after Bloody Sunday and seeing the reaction of people around the nation and around the world, demonstration in more than 80 cities on almost every major college campus in America, saying, it's gonna work out, it's gonna be all right. And then President Lyndon Johnson, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, speaking to the nation, and I think gave one of the most meaningful speeches any American president had given in modern time on the whole question of civil rights and voting rights. And at the end of that speech, he said, and we shall overcome. That was hope.
John Lewis, U.S. Representative from the 5th Congressional District. This past April, the LBJ Presidential Library on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin hosted a Civil Rights Summit to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The summit featured three former presidents and President Obama. It also looked back at the civil rights movement of the 1960s and looked forward to the civil rights issues still facing America and the world. The summit was entitled, We Shall Overcome. President Johnson began his quest for a more just and honorable America with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the most transformational civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, and a critical step in the realization of America's promise. In the years that follow, LBJ passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Together, these three laws ban discrimination based on race, color, sex, religion, or national origin. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, highlights of the Civil Rights Summit to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 with Julian Bond, Andrew Young, and John Lewis, Part 2, In Black America.
I get there, and Jose Williams says, who's going to lead this march with Andrew Young? And they were all ready to march, and so I had seen, you know, a couple of hundred Klansmen out there in the old slave market, and I said, well, I better lead them, and then I can turn them around. When they see what I saw, they won't mind turning around. Except we got there and they saw, and I got them in a circle and we prayed, and I said, nobody needs to go. Dr. King said we should, and somebody started singing, be not dismayed, whatever be tied, God will take care of you. And everybody wanted to go down there and march. And I said, oh Lord. But to keep everybody from getting beat up, I kept them on one side of the street and I went across to try to reason with unreasonable people. But I was doing pretty good until somebody, you know, hit me from the back with a blackjack.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a revolutionary piece of legislation in this country that effectively outlawed egregious forms of discrimination against African Americans and women, including all forms of segregation. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 terminated unequal application in regards to voter registration requirements and all forms of racial segregation in schools, in the workplace, and by facilities that offer services to the general public. On July 2, 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed into law the historic Civil Rights Act. This past April, for 3 days, the LBJ Presidential Library on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin hosted a Civil Rights Summit to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The summit was entitled, We Shall Overcome. On today's edition, we conclude our conversation with the heroes of the civil rights movement. They are Julian Bond, former chairman of the NAACP. While a student at Morehouse, he helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and served as communications director. Andrew Young, former congressman, ambassador to the United Nations, and Atlanta, Georgia mayor. And John Lewis, U.S. representative from the 5th Congressional District. The discussion was moderated by Lonnie G. Bunch, founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Congressman, what about you?
Well, like Julian, When I heard that Dr. King had been assassinated, it was a sad time for me and a very dark hour. I love Dr. King, because if it hadn't been for him, I don't know what would have happened to me. I grew up very, very poor in rural Alabama, and seeing segregation and racial discrimination, he gave me a way out, maybe a way in. But the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence tend to tell us that you should not get lost in a sea of despair, that you should be hopeful. You have to pick yourself up and continue to move. And Andy would say, press on to the mark. You have to keep going. I think one of the great moments of hope when we were marching from Selma to Montgomery after Bloody Sunday and seeing the reaction of people around the nation and around the world, demonstration in more than 80 cities on almost every major college campus in America, saying, it's gonna work out, it's gonna be all right. And then President Lyndon Johnson, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, speaking to the nation, and I think gave one of the most meaningful speeches any American president had given in modern time on the whole question of civil rights and voting rights. And at the end of that speech, he said, and we shall overcome. That was hope. That said it all.
Ambassador?
You know, I think that for me, was a high point of the movement. Sitting with Dr. King and him unable to keep the tears from rolling down. But he had so prepared us for his assassination that we didn't take time to mourn. We could not grieve. We came right back from the hospital and we sat down and we said, they can kill the dreamer, but they cannot kill his dream. And I think we committed to carry on, and we did, but the low point for me then came when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, because I didn't have a follow-up plan. I knew what to do. Dr. King had prepared us, but I was expecting another leader like Lyndon Johnson going to the White House, and we didn't know. The country fell apart, and we lost that election in 1968, which I think we would have won if President Johnson had run. And Dr. King would have backed him. We were against the war in Vietnam. We were not against Lyndon Johnson. And we saw ourselves trying to help him out of the war. But the country was so confused, we lost the movement by one vote per precinct, difference between Nixon and Humphrey. Mm-hmm. And that's where we lost the Supreme Court. That's where we lost the economy. We still haven't figured out why we're poor, still, and why we can't deal. But I went to the Congress shortly after that, and one of the first things Nixon did and that term, after his second term, was to break up the Bretton Woods agreements. Now, I didn't even know what that was, but that was the economic agreement that held the world economy together, tied to the dollar, and the dollar was tied to gold. Mm-hmm. And that meant there was economic stability all over the world from 1944 to 1974. When they broke up that agreement from New Hampshire, in the Congress, in the banking committee where I was sitting and didn't have sense enough to know what was going on, it changed everything. Oil was $2.50 a barrel. Yeah. It went to as high as $160 a barrel. The disequilibrium in the global economy is something that, it's why I say everybody now ought to be studying economics, because the economics of today's world does not make sense. Mm-hmm. And most of us don't even understand how we're getting screwed.
When Robert Kennedy was killed,
I couldn't make up my mind who to support for president. And John was with Robert Kennedy in California, and he called me from California that night, and he said, Bobby has won the primary, and we're going on to New York. He said, meet us in New York. And I said, okay, I will. He said, turn on your TV set. Bobby's going downstairs to make the announcement. And I turned on my TV set, and bam, he was gone. You remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, as you talk about, you know, the deaths and the violence. 2 weeks ago, I guess, I was with Congressman Lewis, and for the first time in my life, I walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And what struck me is that as you get to the top of that bridge, how much you could see and how much further there was before you ran into those Alabama State Troopers. And it struck me because my first thought was, well, I need to turn around. And I wondered, how do you deal with fear? How do you deal with the comrades who were lost, the violence that you suffered on Bloody Sunday? How do you, as individuals, how does the movement deal with that pressure and that fear?
Well, you grow, you come to that point in your life, you have what I call an executive session with yourself, just don't talk back to yourself, and you say, I'm not gonna be afraid, I'm not afraid. I am not afraid. Back in 1961, when we went on the Freedom Ride, when those of us left Nashville, or when we left Washington on May 4th, 1961, the same year that President Obama was born, we were prepared to die. Some of us signed notes and wills that if it took our death, as Dr. King was said to redeem the soul of America, I think some of us were prepared. I thought I was going to die on that bridge. I thought I saw death, but I was not afraid. You had to continue to move on. You get beaten, you get arrested, you get thrown in jail, but maybe you will survive.
But you know, I think, unfortunately, I'm not a sadist, but probably the hour that I am most thrilled about in the Civil Rights Movement was when I got beat up in St. Augustine. Okay. Because I'd been the negotiator, I'd been the behind the scenes guy. I wasn't allowed to go to jail, you know? And all of a sudden, here I am, Dr. King sends me to St. Augustine to stop the demonstration. And I get there and Hosea Williams says, who's gonna lead this march with Andrew Young? And they were all ready to march. And so I had seen, you know, a couple of hundred Klansmen out there in the old slave market. And I said, well, I better lead them and then I can turn them around. When they see what I saw, they won't mind turning around. Except we got there and they saw, and I got them in a circle and we prayed, and I said, nobody needs to go. Dr. King said we should. And somebody started singing, be not dismayed, whatever betide, God will take care of you. And everybody wanted to go down there and march. And I said, oh, Lord. But to keep everybody from getting beat up, I kept them on one side of the street and I went across to try to reason with unreasonable people. But I was doing pretty good until somebody, you know, hit me from the back with a blackjack. And then I didn't know anything, you know, except that somebody was picking me up and I said, no, we can't stop now, we have to go on. And finally we walked on through, but it was almost 40 years later before I saw the pictures, you know, of what happened. But that night I felt good. I felt like, you know, playing football, you run into the line, you get clobbered, you get up, you try it off the next side next time. Mm-hmm. And it was not frightening, though the policeman who pulled me out said that if he hadn't, they would have probably killed me. But I didn't meet him until 45 years later. And he was just happened to be a big 6 foot, 6 inch Greek who had just moved down from New York. And as far as I'm concerned, he's probably the angel that saved me that night.
Julian, what about you?
None of these things ever happened to me. I found myself on occasion in places where I thought something bad might happen, but it never did, never hit, never struck. So I had none of these experiences.
But you still had to find ways to deal with your fears.
Yes. And generally it was to say, well, he's doing it, and he's doing it, and she's doing it, so why can't I do it? Mm.
In some way, since you mentioned she, this is a panel that's ripe with testosterone. So I thought it would be important to talk a little bit about the role of women and gender in the movement, and also to help us understand, were there tensions in terms of the changing identity, changing role of women, and their role here in the movement itself?
Oh, there are all kinds of tensions between men and women in the movement. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was, I think, the best of all these organizations in terms of the way women were treated, really up here compared to many of the others. Even there, we had enormous tensions between men and women over the roles each would play. But women played an enormous role in, if you look at the movement as a totality, had it not been for women, there would not have been a movement. I mean, if you look at organization as old and as venerable as the NAACP, women are just all through this organization, all through the leadership, all through the you know, running things, doing things. Women were indispensable in the movement and are, of course, are indispensable everywhere. But there were always tensions at the same time.
You call a roll, though. You can go back to Mary McLeod Bethune, and the sin of the movement to me was that Dorothy Height, for some reason, didn't get to speak at the
Absolutely.
March on Washington.
But
Rosa Parks, Mrs. Boynton went to Selma in 1929 as a 19-year-old, and she registered to vote when she turned 21 in 1932. She led a get out the vote march in the back of a convertible in 2010 for Barack Obama, the midterm elections. And she's still on the battlefield. She was the one that came to get Dr. King and made us come to Selma. That it was Diane Nash in Nashville who I was in New York and saw on television, and we saw John and Bernard and Bevel, and I knew Jim Lawson from church days. And my wife says to me, it's time for us to go back home. I would not have left New York, probably. on my own, but at every juncture, Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, there just could not have been a movement without the women. When the night when we were marching in St. Augustine, one of the reasons why I had to go was there were no men. It was mostly women and children. And when I went back to the pool hall and I cussed everybody out. And blame the black men who were sitting around saying that they couldn't be nonviolent for getting me beat up. And the next night, they marched with us, about 25 of them marched with us, and the Klan wouldn't bother. I'd say, if there are 25 black men in the march, you won't get touched.
Now, Lenny, I may get in trouble here, but it'll be good trouble.
I agree with Andy and with Julian.
I think there was some male chauvinism. Andy,
hold up.
A great deal. Mentioned Ella Baker. Now, Ella Baker had been working with SCLC, and Dr. King suggested or recommended, maybe just instructed her to coordinate, to bring together all of these young people that were sitting in. And she made the decision to organize this meeting at the school that she graduated from, Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Ella Baker today must be considered the mother of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And even in Montgomery, in 1955, it was a woman by the name of Joanne Robinson.
The women decided that Dr. King should lead.
Should lead.
No, they were the ones. There was a tension between the Baptist and the Methodist preacher.
That's the point I'm going to get to.
Yeah.
The movement had all of these ministers, and a lot of these religious creatures wanted to treat the movement like it was their own church. And
you go to a mass meeting,
the great majority of the people were women. Look at some of those old photographs. You go to people getting ready to go downtown to sit in from the First Baptist Church in Nashville, it was the young women. And Julian is right, a lot of the guys talk about, I can't be nonviolent, I play football. You can be nonviolent. You can stand in line and keep the peace. So women played a major role. Without women, without the young women, middle-aged women, older women, there wouldn't have been a modern-day civil rights movement.
You know, one of the reasons why I can understand racism is I understand sexism. Mm. I had to tell my own daughters, I said, look, do not listen to me. I am your oppressor. I want you to be sweet and cute and sit on my lap and be daddy's little girl, and you start talking about being a lawyer and an engineer, I'm going to do everything I can to discourage you. One of them packs up and says, I'm going to Uganda. Oh, no, baby, please. But daddy, you preach that all the time, but not for you. You know? And you have, my children had to resist my projecting my male chauvinism onto them. And I encouraged it, even though I fought against it.
I think the chance to help people remember people like Ella Baker. I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, as you're thinking about the way we remember the movement, are there other people that quickly come to mind to you that we've lost their story, or we don't understand how central they were to the movement?
I don't think it's that we didn't know how central they were, because those of us who knew them knew how central they were. But I think history, the larger history, has forgotten these women. There are three excellent books written about Ella Baker, mm-hmm. wonderful books that tell her story. And you could read all three of them to some great profit. But I doubt if they have many sales. I doubt if they're promoted a great deal by their publishers.
But in our defense, let's say that Martin was 25, 30. I was 3 years younger. I'm still trying to break away from my mama. See, he's still trying. His mother was one of the strongest, most domineering females you ever want to meet. She dominated Daddy King. She ran Ebenezer Baptist Church. We couldn't work under Ella Baker. Mm. You know, I mean, it just was a psychological barrier there. And so we passed on over to SNCC. we were trying to break away from our mamas, and they still needed a mama. And she was a good one.
She was a good mother, and she was older, but I tell you, she was as radical and as focused, and she was always pointing us to push.
It was she who told us not to join SCLC, not to join the NAACP, not to join these older civil rights organizations that have been around for years and years, and in our opinion, hadn't done anything. She said, don't join them, start something new, something brand new. And we started the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Well, Constance Baker Motley mm-hmm. did as much of the work for the NAACP as Thurgood Marshall or Jack Greenberg. I'd say it's throughout the movement.
And President Johnson appointed her to a judgeship, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Constance Baker Motley.
Yeah. Yes, my niece is named after her.
You know, I was on the plane coming here, and it was full of students. And we began to talk to them about this event. And two things struck me. First, President Carter walked down the aisle and shook everyone's hand, right? Everyone. But as he passed where my wife was sitting, several of the students said, "Now who's Jimmy Carter?" So after we lectured for about an hour, but the other thing that they asked us, I said, "Well, what do you want to know?" And they said to me, "We want to understand what are the civil rights issues today. We want to understand what you would tell us who are trying to become activists. What would you tell us, that what are the lessons that you've learned? What are the lessons that you pass on to us?" In essence, one woman said to me, "How do you help us help America?"
Well, I'm getting older, so I'm worried about the judgment. And what Jesus asks is, "Did you feed the hungry? Did you clothe the naked? Did you heal the sick? Did you set at liberty those who were oppressed?" Now, he doesn't mean passing out missionary baskets in this day and age. He means we've got to find a way to define an economic order where we wipe out hunger on the face of the earth, see, and where the people can be clothed and housed. And there is enough wealth. There's enough technology. There's enough understanding of human need. But we have not developed the vision to put it all together and make it work. And that's an economic vision. It's a global vision. It's a technical vision. And somebody was telling me what they were hearing about Twitter, about this conference, and I don't know about Twitter. So that's y'all's movement. And somehow that there has got to be some global understanding of how the resources of the earth are utilized to solve the problems of hunger, of disease, and war.
I think the most pressing need for young people and for all Americans, for all of us, is to move with more than all deliberate speed to create a truly multicultural, multiracial, democratic society. It doesn't make sense in our country, in America, on this little piece of real estate, to have millions and millions of people living in the shadow.
John Lewis, U.S. Representative from the 5th Congressional District. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future in Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.